This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. We continue to break or deal with, you know, outbreaks and some progress and then some setbacks. Dr. Rhonda Meadows, though, Tim, is president of population health over at Providence Health System, one of the largest nonprofit health systems in the U.S. And you might remember they were home to the first confirmed COVID case back in early 2020. So we really appreciate their perspective. She joins us on the phone in Renton, Washington. Dr. Meadows, good to have you back with Tim and myself. How are you and what are you guys seeing there out west when it comes to COVID?
It's great to be back with you. And what we are seeing is we still have some areas of spikes. Mm-hmm. Surge is still occurring, like in eastern Washington, Montana, and Alaska. But thankfully, we're seeing a little bit of plateauing in California, as well as in parts of Oregon. Washington seems to be fairly stable as well. We're not over the hump, but it's seeing a little bit.
Dr. Meadows,
daylight coming through.
Just to confirm, are these outbreaks, are these happening in unvaccinated populations?
Predominantly unvaccinated. Very small percent are vaccinated.
Is there any sort of... Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, the few that I think are breakthrough vaccinated are usually people who are immune compromised or have other chronic illnesses behind them, but mostly unvaccinated.
And are you right now, where are you right now falling when it comes to boosters and what you're seeing as far as people coming in who want boosters or guidance coming from doctors about who should get a booster?
So we're seeing a lot of questions and inquiries coming in, and we are actually sharing with them what we know, including the most recent announcement coming about the FDA panel of advisors recommending boosters for people who are immune compromised. We're waiting for their final word on people who are over the age of 65 getting it, who are otherwise healthy. Patients are asking about it. You know, it's kind of a mixed bag depending on which community you're in. Some are anxious to get it, and some still are waiting to get the first shot.
I'm like, poke me as much as you want. I got my flu shot this morning. I'm like,
oh,
just go
good.
Ahead. No, but it is important, and I do wonder, we keep reminding Dr. Meadows, you understand this so well about the importance of community, and so the importance of individuals who don't even have a first shot of getting a first shot, of making sure the developing world is getting vaccinated, because we can't move forward as a global society and community unless most people get some form of vaccination, right, or some kind of immunity.
You are absolutely correct. If we leave anybody uncovered, it becomes a hot spot that then can then spread. It's also a hot spot for mutations to occur. So everybody needs to get it.
So I am curious, there was something I was reading or listening to this morning that I think was looking at China specifically, how maybe they shut down kind of their cities. I mean, this is it. This is how it's going to be moving forward. I mean, you can't convince maybe everybody to get a vaccine. We kind of know that already. So are we going to be constantly in a state of, we'll see some COVID outbreaks, people will be getting boosters? I don't know. Like, that's what I'm trying to understand.
You know, I think, first of all, I think it's too early to tell, but I can tell you that I'm going to agree with you that I hope certainly not. I think what's going to happen is we'll slowly but surely convince more people to get the vaccine. The people who actually have gotten sick from COVID may now become our best spokespeople for encouraging their family and communities to do it. But I don't think this is going to continue just forever. That's not the way that vaccines and pandemics work. So I think what we're going to find is that we're going to see the counts starting to go down again, closer coming into December, unless another new variant comes up. And I think eventually over the next couple of years, it'll start to blend in a little bit more. So you just mentioned you got your flu vaccine. There may be a time when we're getting a flu vaccine and a COVID mixed together, combination vaccine.
Fine.
Tim's like, sign
great.
Me up.
Yeah, yesterday. I will do that yesterday. Dr. Meadows, as a parent, what should we know about or how concerned should we be about kids? What are you seeing in the Providence Health System when it comes to kids who are severely ill, those who don't even have the chance right now to get vaccinated because they're not old enough?
we're seeing an increase in the number of children who not only are testing positive, but even because it's the magnitude of the number of people are exposed, including children, we're seeing more kids coming into our hospitals and becoming more severely ill. Thankfully, the mortality or death rate from them is still relatively low. But I got to tell you, if it's just one kid and it's my kid, yeah, that's way too many.
Agreed.
That out there.
Agreed. Dr. Meadows, sit tight. We just have to do a little bit of news, but we will come back and would love to continue with you. Dr. Rhonda Meadows is our guest, president of population health at Providence Health System, joining us on the phone from Wenton, Washington. Are you just kind of waiting? I mean, you have a little one.
Yeah, we do. So part of the reason I was off over the last week is because he started preschool. So we did, it's like a phase-in thing. All parents are familiar with this. When kids start preschool, you know, they're going into an hour and a half, and then eventually, you know, a few hours, and then all day. But, you know, he's not keeping his mask on. He's 2 and a half. He's supposed to wear a mask at school, not keeping his mask on. But who can blame him? He's 2 and a half. And it's not required at the school. It's suggested, but you can't really require a 2 and a half-year-old to wear a mask.
Right, exactly, right. They're little critters, and like, so what do you do? So are you kind of bracing?
Yeah, well, so they do weekly tests, which is great.
Of the kids?
Yeah, of the kids. Ah. Yeah. It's very hard to teach a 2-year-old how to spit. Any parent will know that. He has no idea. Yeah,
but then you get a kid who learns how to do it and then it just doesn't stop.
Yeah, great. That's probably what's going to happen.
Stay tuned. All right, folks, we're going to come back with Dr. Meadows in just a moment, talking about the day's latest COVID headlines. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser, my co-host Tim Stenovic. This is Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, let's get back to Dr. Rhonda Meadows. She's president of population health at Providence Health System, still with us on the phone in Renton, Washington. So one of the things that we've certainly seen is society stressed. We've seen healthcare workers stressed. Dr. Meadows, what are you seeing on that front?
So absolutely, not just stressed, but exhausted and dismayed by some of the contempt that they feel for the very people that they're trying to help. Hmm. So our cases are increasing, our hospitalizations
are... What do you mean by that? What do you mean anecdotally?
Actually, what I mean is not only are people that are unvaccinated coming in to seeking care, but some of those same people are standing outside of our hospitals who are protesting against vaccinations. They get letters left on their car shield when they come out from a long shift working in the emergency room or in the hospital. They see the social media disparaging comments against them, what they're trying to do. So it's not just about the vaccine. It's basically about their efforts to try to help people and save people and promote the science of getting a vaccine, reducing the transmission, and reducing the number of people who need hospital care in the first place.
Well, we live in a world of scarce resources, and one narrative that has emerged over the last few weeks has been the way that ICUs in certain parts of the country have filled up, and you see percentages in the high 90s in some places in the past few weeks. And I wonder about the decisions that doctors have to make about, okay, who is able to use this scarce resource that we have, whether it's you know, a certain number of nurses per patient or a certain number of patients per nurse. And I'm wondering what goes through a doctor's head when they have to make those decisions.
Well, first, I can tell you that the doctors aren't making the decisions alone. We are actually well prepared to try to make the decisions. They're still hard. I think what you're referring to is when we go to a crisis standard of care, when we're trying to make a decision about what little resources, how will we use them, and who will we use them for, and how do we decide that kind of stuff. You know, you never want to be in a position where you're having to ration care, but that's where we are in some places. And, Tim, I want to tell you, it's not just about rationing care for people who are being treated for COVID. It's rationing resources for anybody who needs that ventilator, oxygen therapy, the doctors, the nurses.
Well, that's what I mean. It must be frustrating to patients and to caregivers if people who are using resources that essentially don't need to be there, people who could have been vaccinated and wouldn't even be in the hospital and perhaps are making it more difficult on patients who have a heart attack or some other emergency condition.
You are absolutely right. And we see that and we feel it. And for the most part, I think our doctors, nurses, caregivers that are they're trying their best to do what they can, but they're only human.
Well, we wish you luck.
They're only human.
Exactly. And that's something we need to remember in terms of what's going on today, what's going on tomorrow. And we really appreciate getting another glimpse of what you are seeing. Dr. Rhonda Meadows, stay safe, be well, president of Population Health at Providence Health System, as you might recall, home to the first COVID-19 case confirmed back in January of 2020. She joined us on the phone from Renton, Washington. That's tough.
It's tough. And, Carol, we're approaching the two-year mark as to where, you know, when COVID was circulating around the world and in the United States. And it's just, it's mind-boggling to think about
2 years.
That. 2 years. Here we are in the fall of 2021.
And I know, like, my daughter's gone back to school. She's in college now, and they have a vaccination policy, but they gave some leeway of kids to get vaccines after they came back to school. And there are cases coming out, and they're keeping kids in classes, but they're trying to, you know, trying to make it work, but it's tough.
So in college, masks in class?
Masks in class.
Everyone's masked
up. Any closed place, yep. Yep. And there is a vaccine mandate, but again, they were allowing kids to kind of get vaccines.
But so far, so good?
So far, so good. But there are cases, though, that are definitely breaking out.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the upcoming Sooner Than You Think issue of Bloomberg Business Week, out later this week, already, though, on the Bloomberg and at businessweek.com. It's a story that takes us, Tim, inside Amazon's flagship fulfillment center outside Seattle, and it's all about algorithms and robots. They rule.
Sooner than you think, they're here already. Joel Weber is editor at Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Matt Day is technology reporter. He wrote the story. He's with Bloomberg News, and he joins us on the phone from Seattle. Joel, what is so special about this one fulfillment center that Matt profiles?
So it's outside Seattle, and it has the reputation of being a flagship, sort of almost like a test lab, I guess you could think of it as. And I think part of that is just, you know, proximity to HQ.
You can get those executives coming by and saying, hey, wait a second, how do you guys do things here?
But what they've really done, you know, the significance of this is that this was the first fulfillment center that was able to process more than 1 million packages a day. And so obviously that, you know, once they optimized that, it was like, where else can we take it? And the secret to that, though, as Matt has revealed, is that there's a lot of algorithms. There's a few robots. And the humans work for all of them. Right, Matt?
Yeah, that's right. Honestly, the starting point for this story, I met a guy who used to work at Amazon, went and jumped somewhere else. And he said, man, I'm doing so many things that I never had to do back when I was at an Amazon warehouse. They had just automated all of that for me.
Well, tell us more as you walk BFI-4, which is this massive fulfillment center outside Seattle. Tell us about it. Did you go visit?
I did, yeah, and it's a place I've been a couple of times over the years writing about Amazon. You know, as Joel said, they love to have folks in for tours. They're really proud of the facility. It's just a big exurban rectangle, size of 15 football fields. You go in, and there's this kind of low hum. But the weird thing for me is it's kind of quiet. You know, everybody's sort of in their own station. You know, most people probably by number are putting something in a shelf that's brought to them by a robot or retrieving something from a shelf and sending it on down the line. You know, a couple of thousand people a day, just, you know, doing roughly most of them the same task over and over again, whether that's picking something off the shelf, putting it in a package and taking orders from a smartphone app the whole time.
What does your instinct tell you about a facility like this when you walk inside it and you see it? Does it seem like, given the number of packages it's able to process a day, does it seem like more people should be there?
You know, it really does. The place is there's that low hum, but it is kind of eerily quiet. Like you would assume hearing figures like 1 million packages a day that there'd be more frenzy. But Amazon's just got it down to such a science that everyone's just sort of, you know, quietly going about their business at their station.
Quietly working for algorithms and robots. So what is the human toll of that?
Even told that, well, it's you know, working in an Amazon warehouse is often an unpleasant place, and that's been widely reported. Amazon's productivity tracking systems are real precise, right? They can tell when you're working, they can tell when you put down the scanner, you know. So if you're in one of these frontline jobs, there's always this voice. You know, sometimes it's just literally a countdown clock on your workstation telling you, you know, exactly what they expect you to be able to do. And Amazon, a very aggressive company, sets that target real high. So that's the life for the front line. But one of the things that interested me, especially given that story is so well known, is so what the heck do managers do in this construct, right? If these people are working kind of self-directed, what are the people, you know, at the top of the pyramid in a building like this? What do they all do all day?
Well, they get to manage a lot more people, right?
They do. And a lot of what they do is HR, essentially. You know, they're trying to get the best out of people. They're trying to troubleshoot when something goes wrong. You know, just because, again, all of the software whizzes at Amazon have taken things out of their hands, right? They don't do staffing planning at a granular way a lot of, you know, warehouses in any company will do, right? Most places you go to work and, you know, the boss or the schedule tells you where to go. Here, the schedule is worked out by algorithm, right? There's just so much that's been taken off their shoulders, you know, kind of with the aim of getting this thin line of managers to effectively manage thousands and thousands of people.
So when you think about this, oh, actually, just real basic question. What's BFI4 stand for? What is that?
So it is a reference to an airport in Seattle called Boeing Field. Every Amazon building across the country takes its name from whatever the regional airport is.
Okay, so that was a basic question I forgot to ask during the edit.
But a good
confession.
One.
But
you get to know how the sausage is made when Joel comes to the studio.
So Matt, the other thing is, you know, obviously this is somewhat of a secret weapon for Amazon and has allowed them to really become such a dominant company. But how does this automation compare with, you know, the Walmarts and the Targets of the world that compete with them?
Folks are definitely closing the gap. Amazon has, you know, built a lot of its technology. It's bought a lot of its technology. We read about their seminal acquisition of a little robot maker called Kiva back in 2012. That gave them a real big head start. But companies, you know, are imitating what Amazon does, and they are closing that gap, right? Amazon's biggest advantage a few years ago was getting things out of these buildings as fast as they can. You know, today they're looking for secret sauce, just because, you know, the Targets of the world, the Walmarts of the world are kind of taking their cues from Amazon's roboticized fulfillment and putting it in their own operations.
Matt, from a financial perspective, the ultimate goal for any company that has this many employees is to reduce the number of employees because they're so expensive. Help us see into the future and Amazon's ability to actually automate nearly everything.
Yeah, Amazon has set aside full automation as a long-term goal. It's something their technology teams and their roboticists are working toward. I think realistically, they don't see that as practical for a long, long time. But that doesn't mean they can't get savings along the way, right? We talked to some folks who had insight into their Kiva acquisition and said they saved something like 30% on labor costs in the first implementations of their robots come to people operating method. So there's definitely a lot of cost that Amazon can look to reduce, you know, without going kind of that dream of a fully automated facility that doesn't require any humans at all.
So how much better has this stuff gotten with practice and time? Is there any sense of that?
We do know that, how to call it, in a 5 or 6 year period, they were maybe three times as fast, right? State of the art warehouse, you know, roughly a decade ago, was doing something like 300,000 items a day, as you mentioned, kicking us off. This facility can do a million plus. That stat, though, I put an asterisk on, that's getting a couple of years old now. So it would not surprise me at all if Amazon is setting a new threshold and just isn't quite ready to brag about it yet.
All right. So to be feared or imitated or both?
Oh, it's certainly both, depending on your line of work. But yeah, they've definitely reshaped warehousing in their image with this kind of technology.
It's an incredible read. Matt Day, thank you. Tech reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us from Seattle. Joel Weber in our Interactive Broker studio. But I think it's interesting because I think we expect robots and automation to take some of the lower-level jobs, but it sounds like you'll need fewer, maybe higher-paying managers also in the process if other companies start to follow what Amazon's doing.
I think it's like inevitable that other companies will, right? Like
if you can go from
300,000 packages a day to a million, it's like, how do I get that?
How do I get that and how do I reduce costs in the process?
Yeah. All right. Sign of the future. All right. We got to run. Joel Weber, thank you so much. Check this out. Sooner Than You Think, that's the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. You are listening to Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So the FOMC, Federal Reserve Open Market Committee, kicking off its two-day meeting today. Decision we know expected tomorrow. Fed officials, Tim, expected to hold interest rates near zero while telegraphing tapering of the Fed's $120 billion in monthly bond purchases in that policy statement that we get at 2 p.m. Wall Street time tomorrow. But of interest, of course, as always, Jay Powell's press conference, what he has to say about some of the concerns on investors' minds, Evergrande, COVID, debt ceilings, inflation, jobs, QE. On that subject, Bridgewater's Ray Dalio caught up with our Tom Keene earlier today, and Dalio saying another round of quantitative easing. Yep, another round, not out of the question.
I think we're going to get another round. Another round of QE.
You're predicting another round of QE.
Not immediately. I think that what happens is you get a taper. I think like every tightening of interest rates has been less than the one before it since 1980. And then when we had zero, then we did QE, and every QE has been larger than the one before it, because we've accumulated so much debt and that we're now printing. I think that you'll have probably one pullback, and then you set the markets down, because the duration of the bond market and the duration of assets is longer. That means interest rate sensitivity is greater. You have that particular correction, and then you'll have another round of that.
Fascinating. Bridgewater's Ray Dalio earlier with our Tom Keene. Let's get another perspective. So glad to have back with us Stephen Skanke, Chief Economic Advisor at Keel Point, former U.S. Treasury and White House National Security Council staff member based in Washington, D.C., and that's where we find him. Steve, good to have you here with Tim and myself. So let's get that perspective. What do you think about another round of QE at some point?
Well, Carol, thanks. Thanks for having me back. It's always a pleasure to be with you. It certainly is possible that we'll need to have another round of QE, but that isn't going to be what's out of the gate next. The Fed is looking to start a tapering program. The market is expecting that. August showed weak employment growth and moderating inflation, so it's not like they have to do anything. I think it's fair to say that overall the economy hasn't made substantial further progress, which is their touchstone. But they will talk about it. They will try to work out a plan. I believe that they will hint at when it begins. But to the point that Ray Dalio made, they could get into it and find out that they have to reverse course.
Why do you think what tells you, what's the data that you point to when you say that the economy has not made further substantial progress?
Well, just the August employment numbers were far weaker than consensus and certainly what the Fed is looking for. Even the expectation of retail sales, which turned out to be fine, were below what folks need to see that the economy is really getting traction. I mean, it doesn't look like it's collapsing, but it's not creating jobs at a pace that the Fed is needing it to do.
Still millions more still millions more, Steve, to get back to work. I mean, could we possibly be facing a scenario where not all of those jobs come back and it's a different economy post-pandemic?
I think we're seeing that already, Carol, that it's going to be a different economy. The fact that the unemployment rate is falling, but we still have large numbers of people looking for work. The estimates as to how many people are looking for full-time work and jobs that they would like to have is way beyond the number of people who are listed as unemployed. The fact that we don't have any positive movement in the labor force participation rate means that the growth opportunity is necessarily constrained. The impact of COVID, particularly in the United States, continues to be a big issue. And the government, you could just see, is struggling to see how that's going to get worked out. The moves that the president made a couple of weeks ago were surprising, but I think they point to the level of angst and concern about what has to happen to getting people back into the labor force and back to work and back contributing to productive economic growth.
Does that mismatch between demand for jobs and supply of jobs, does that tell you that we are going to see serious wage increases from employers, and that is a sign that inflation will be here to stay?
We certainly can expect to see significant, meaningful increases in wages to get the people back to work. It seems to be that there's a couple of things going on. One is technical and technology based. There have been some interesting articles on it, on how the automation of resume scanning has put a big obstacle in getting resumes of people who would like the jobs actually hired into the jobs. The second thing, the concern about COVID has kept a lot of people
yeah.
whose ballot sheets are just fine from going back into the workplace.
Yeah, we see that a lot. Hey, just got about 45, 50 seconds here. Steve, I wanted to ask you, Evergrande or China remaking its economy, are we likely to hear anything from the Fed on that? And should we, or do you want to hear from the Fed on that?
Well, I certainly don't want to hear from the Fed about that. If we hear from the Fed, it means it's way worse than any of us think it is or ought to be.
Wow.
I think at the end of the day, that's probably not a big issue for the U.S. economy.
Yeah.
It certainly sparked some fear in markets. But I think the good news about Evergrande is that that negative impact gets worked out pretty quickly.
Hey, 30 more seconds really quickly, though. But if China's remaking its economy, are Andy Brown of Bloomberg saying, you know, we may have to get accustomed to much lower growth rates in China. Is that something that would ultimately impact the global economy in a big way and possibly the U.S.? Just quickly.
Yes, it will have a negative impact on global economic growth, but I think not so much on the United States.
You are a gem. Come back soon. Steve Skanke, he is Chief Economic Advisor at Keel Point, former U.S. Treasury and White House National Security Council staff member based in Washington, D.C. That's where we found him. Taking lots of notes from that.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. We have been bouncing around. We're off our highs and lows of the session. Green on the screen, though, with those major equity averages, but little changes in particular for the Dow and the S&P NASDAQ up 0.4%, as we heard from Charlie. Biggest gain there among those major equity averages. Let's get to it. Drive to the Close with Eric Schoenstein. He is Managing Director, Portfolio Manager at Jensen Investment Management. They've got more than $13.4 billion in assets under management. Among the funds that he helps manage, the Jensen Quality Growth Fund, which Tim is beating most of its peers in the past 3 years, up nearly 14% on average annually, according to Bloomberg data. Eric, good to have you here. What's front and center for you?
Well, first and foremost, thank you for having me.
Sure.
Front and center for us as an investment team, you know, probably trying to parse through, as I'm sure many of your investing folks are, is trying to parse through all the various risks and you know how they're going to impact companies, impact the economy, and what that means for our investment strategy. The good news is for us is our investment strategy has always been focused on, you know, what we consider to be high quality companies that are frankly resilient in the face of risk, and so we think our companies are built to handle them. But nonetheless, risk assessment, I think, is what is front and center right now.
Well, yeah, and I think China also front and center. I wonder, these high quality companies, many of them do business, I assume, in China. I mean, think about Apple, for example, and the kind of business mm-hmm. that Apple does in China. I'm wondering how you, Eric, weigh China risk right now.
Well, it's certainly one of the elements that needs to be weighed. I think we have a you know, you can certainly say we have geopolitical risk as something that needs to be considered now, perhaps in ways that it didn't need to be considered a few years
ago. Why do you say that? Because we've gone through, well, you know, 9/11. We've gone through some really serious stuff over the last 2 decades or so. So what's different now? Is it just the China story that's the geopolitical, or what's the geopolitical?
No, I think, what I was referring to really is more the China story. I mean, geopolitical in terms of, you know, terrorist activity and some of the other things that have happened, yes, and those are things that should be considered. But I think from the standpoint of how, you know, trading partners and China's growth as an economy, growth as a nation that is more formidable, they're certainly trying to play a larger part on the world stage, and that has real impact on every company that does business in China, and certainly the ones we invest in are not immune to that. I think that a bit of the difference for us from our perspective would be that, you know, these are multinational companies, and so I don't know that we're necessarily in a position where China would be, you know, the largest part of any one of these businesses or their revenue streams, and they so there's some level of insulation, but nonetheless, it's just one of the many things that we have to be thinking about, both domestically as well as globally, in terms of the impact on our business.
Well, I take it you're not invested in casinos that have a large portion of operations in Macau. Because some of those,
they don't,
some of those companies,
typically the casino side of things doesn't meet our screen. Our screen, because of the consistency and quality, means, you know, that they have to, companies for us have to generate a 15% return on equity every year for 10 consecutive years at a minimum, which means their business return is consistently above their cost of capital. And casinos are a lot of fun, but they don't necessarily meet that criteria for us.
So, Eric, how do you read into what happened yesterday in the markets, and whether or not we see this as a signal, or you see this as a signal, that there could be a further pullback ahead?
I think what happened yesterday is emblematic of the fact that the market's searching for something to help direct it. And, you know, we've got a lot of moving parts, everything from what is the Fed going to do to what kind of tax legislation is going to be out there to what kind of spending. How are we going to treat the fact that we're going to have a fairly large gap in terms of, you know, economic stimulus from what was provided this year to what's provided next year? And all of that creates a bit more of a troublesome direction in terms of trying to think about where things are headed. And so any event like what happened yesterday with China can become a catalyst for volatility. And I think that's what we're probably facing in the times in the or in the weeks and months ahead, is the potential for higher volatility. Mm-hmm. The antidote to us for higher volatility is to look for companies that are less variable in their business performance, and that speaks to our high quality investing style.
All right, so you have to pick names, and you do pick names for the funds that you manage and help manage. Mm-hmm. I mentioned the Jensen Quality Growth Fund, which is got a bunch of investments in names like Apple, Microsoft, PepsiCo. There's the Jensen Quality Value Fund that I think I mentioned in terms of the performance. That's invested in things like, I think, Crown and Hasbro, Equifax. Tell me, how are you picking names right now? Are you finding lots of opportunities?
We actually are still finding good opportunities. I think the reality is that, you know, everything that happened last year from a momentum perspective was really focused on, you know, concentrated on very large companies and just a few stocks. The average company was mostly left behind. And from a valuation perspective, even in the last month or so, you know, we've seen the average stock probably drop in double digits, 12% or so. And so,
so that's an opportunity.
From a valuation perspective, that presents opportunity. I think the key, though, for us is it's not strictly about valuation discipline. It also has to be a very strong fundamental opportunity, and that's where you can see, you know, in our portfolio, you mentioned the Quality Growth Fund, for instance, you can see a Microsoft alongside a Pepsi. Now, clearly, there are different growth rates. There are also different valuation opportunities, but our focus is to try to find 25 to 30 really great combinations of fundamental strength and valuation opportunity to comprise the portfolio. And the same thing would be true in the value strategy, although it's a little bit larger, 25 to 40 companies and a little bit smaller in cap. You know, but in every case, the pillar of fundamental strength based on high business returns against their cost of capital, and then the valuation opportunity is really what drives us.
All right. Listen, thanks. Great to check in with you. Eric Schoenstein, Managing Director, Portfolio Manager, Jensen Investment Management. I did mention fund performance before. It's the Jensen Quality Growth Value Fund, which is beating most of its peers in the past 3 years, up nearly 14% on average annually. So I just wanted to make sure that I was clear about that.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.